So imagine reading a legal document, right? And it explicitly demands that you burn a criminal alive
Right.
simply because they burned someone else. I mean, it is visceral, it is absolute, and according to the text, it is commanded directly by God.
Yeah, it's incredibly intense.
But then, you turn a few pages, skip ahead a few centuries, and you find the exact same God telling you that if someone strikes you, you should turn the other cheek, like literally offer them the other side of your face.
It's a complete inversion, really, of everything that was established up to that point.
Exactly. So, welcome to this custom-tailored deep dive. We have a really fascinating stack of source material today, primarily these excerpts from this document, covenanttheology.pdf.
And our mission here isn't just to, gawk at these jarring contrasts between the actions and commands of God the Father in the Old Testament and Jesus the Son in the New Testament.
Right. We want to actually explore how Orthodox theology survives these contradictions without splitting God in two. Because whether you are brushing up on theology or you just love a really good intellectual puzzle, you have to admit that this shift in tone, it isn't just a minor update.
Oh, no, it'll
It
change.
looks like a completely different religion.
It absolutely does look that way. The tension between the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament is, I mean, it's one of the most extensively studied problems in history.
Yeah.
And what we are going to look at today are the actual frameworks that scholars use to make sense of a textual landscape that honestly seems entirely contradictory on its surface.
Okay, let's unpack this by starting with probably the most famous ethical contrast in human history, which is individual justice versus mercy.
Right. So to understand the sheer scale of the shift, we have to look at the mechanics of the Old Testament law,
Yeah.
specifically, what the text attributes to the Father.
Okay.
It institutes a system of strict proportional retribution, which is known historically as lex
The
talionis.
law of retaliation.
Right. It's exactly.
Because the source gives us Exodus 21 verses 23 through 25. And I mean, it doesn't leave any room for interpretation. It says, but if there is serious injury, you are to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. I mean, burn for burn is as strictly penal as you can possibly get.
It is a mathematically precise system of justice. Now, to a modern reader, that sounds incredibly
Oh,
barbaric.
totally.
But we have to look at how this functioned mechanically in the ancient Near East. Before this kind of law, justice was defined by escalating blood feuds.
Okay, what do you mean?
Well, if a neighboring tribe stole one of your sheep, the standard response wasn't to just steal a sheep back. It was to go and burn their entire village to the ground.
Oh, wow. Okay, so it's like asymmetrical warfare. Like you hurt me a little bit and I just destroy you entirely.
Exactly, yeah. So lex talionis actually functioned as a radical cap on vengeance. It legally restricted the retaliation.
So it's saying, like, you can't go overboard.
Right. It said, no, if they take an eye, you were legally only permitted to take an eye, nothing more.
Right.
It stabilized society by making the punishment exactly match the crime. But crucially, it still fundamentally relied on retribution as the actual mechanism for justice.
Right, so it's a ceiling on vengeance. But then, we jump forward to the teachings of the Son in the New Testament, and Jesus doesn't just quietly phase this out. He points a giant spotlight right at it.
He really does.
Because in Matthew 5, he explicitly quotes that exact Exodus passage to his followers. He says, "You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth, but I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also."
What's fascinating here is a deliberate subversion of it all. He isn't offering a mild critique or some small amendment.
Right.
He is taking the foundational mechanism of ancient justice, which is retribution, and actively collapsing it.
Just dismantling it entirely.
Exactly. He is setting up a completely new paradigm where the cycle of violence is actually absorbed by the victim and halted entirely, rather than being perpetuated legally.
Wow.
And the texts go out of the way to show him modeling this exact non-retaliation during his own trial and execution.
Right. But a slap on the cheek is one thing. What happens when the stakes are literally life and death? Because the source notes that the Mosaic law, the law of the Father, mandates immediate capital punishment for moral infractions.
It does, yes.
Like Leviticus 20:10 dictates that if a man commits adultery with another man's wife, both are to be put to death, usually by stoning.
Which, we should note, is a communal, highly physical, and permanent purging of an infraction from the society.
Right. The community actively participates in the execution, like they throw the rocks.
Exactly.
And here is where the text gets just dizzying. Because in the book of John, chapter 8, Jesus is presented with a real-time live fire scenario. A woman caught in adultery is dragged right in front of him. The crowd literally has stones in their hands. They are completely legally justified under the law of the Father to kill her right there on the spot.
According to the text.
And Jesus actively intervenes to protect a guilty person from that exact divine mandate. He says, you know, let any one of you who's without sin be the first to throw a stone at her. The crowd drops the stones and he tells the woman, neither do I condemn you.
He offers complete grace, effectively just nullifying the mandated death penalty in that exact moment.
Okay, this is where I have to step in and push back a little.
Go for it.
Because if you are reading this text, you have to ask, how do we even begin to square a mandate for immediate capital punishment with Jesus actively protecting a guilty person from that exact law?
Yeah, it's a huge shift.
It's not a subtle shift. It's a complete 180-degree contradiction.
It is a profound contradiction if you view the texts as a flat, unchanging legal code.
Right.
The New Testament presents Jesus as embodying a system where grace just supersedes the law entirely. But you're completely right to feel that tension, because the early readers of these texts, they felt it too.
Well, here's where it gets really interesting. Because if strict retribution is how the Old Testament handles an individual threat, like an adulterer or someone who punches you, how does that logic scale when the threat is much bigger? Like, say, an entire hostile nation.
Right. It scales to total annihilation. When we move from individual justice to the societal macro level, the tension of the text becomes deeply uncomfortable.
Very.
Let's look at the treatment of enemies.
Hmm.
In the Old Testament, the Father frequently commands the total physical destruction of Israel's enemies.
Yeah, the example in the source material is 1 Samuel 15:3. God commands King Saul regarding a rival nation, the Amalekites. And the command isn't just to, you know, defeat their army.
Yeah.
It specifically lists attack and destroy men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys. I mean, total annihilation of every breathing thing.
Yeah, the historical term for this is the ban, or harem. It means something is completely devoted to destruction as an act of severe divine judgment and preservation for Israel.
Okay.
It was essentially a scorched earth policy. It was designed to completely remove a perceived existential threat, both physical and spiritual.
But again, look at how the Son handles the exact same scenario. In Luke 9, Jesus and his disciples are trying to travel through a Samaritan village, right? And the village rejects them.
Right.
His top disciples, James and John, they presumably grew up reading these heroic stories of figures like Saul and Joshua destroying enemies like the Amalekites.
Sure.
So they look at Jesus and ask, Lord, do you want us to call fire down from heaven to destroy them?
They are essentially asking permission to enact harem. They think they are correctly applying the Old Testament model for dealing with hostile outsiders.
Exactly. And honestly, based on their holy text, you can't really blame them for thinking that's the standard operating procedure.
Not at all.
But Jesus turns and rebukes them. He shuts down the idea of divine violence entirely. And in Matthew 5, he commands his followers to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Like, he demands active love to the very people the Old Testament might have slated for absolute destruction.
The texts are demanding that the reader hold two intensely polarized images in their mind at the exact same time.
Yeah, it's wild.
You have the command for the destruction of infants and livestock on one hand, and the command to actively love and pray for your persecutors on the other.
And the friction doesn't even stop with external enemies. It scales inward, too,
yeah,
to the people inside their own society who are struggling. Let's talk about the mechanics of ritual purity and separation. Because the source points out that the Father established a rigidly strict system to keep the Israelites separate, not just from other nations, but from impurity itself.
Yes, the purity laws. I mean, Leviticus 11 details massive lists of clean and unclean foods. But it goes so much further than just diet. Leviticus 13 deals with physical ailments, specifically skin diseases that were broadly categorized as leprosy.
And the mechanics of this are just heartbreaking. The source notes that people with leprosy were commanded to be physically isolated outside the camp.
Yeah.
If anyone approached them, they were legally forced to cry out, "Unclean! Unclean!" I mean, think about the psychological horror of that.
It's devastating.
The utter physical isolation, the mandate to verbally announce your own unworthiness, to even be near another human being.
You have to understand how contagion, both physical and spiritual, was viewed in the ancient world. It was a massive existential concern.
Right.
The theological rule was simple. If the clean touched the clean became defiled. Holiness was incredibly fragile.
So it had to be protected.
Exactly. Protected by physical walls, dietary restrictions, and social isolation. Strict separation was viewed as the absolute only way to maintain the survival of the community.
But then enter the Son. Jesus intentionally and repeatedly bypasses these physical purity laws.
He does.
In Matthew 8, a man with leprosy approaches him. Under the law of the Father, Jesus should recoil, right? He should distance himself to protect his own purity. But instead, the text says, Jesus reaches out his hand and actually touches the man to heal him.
Which, mechanically speaking, should have rendered Jesus ritually impure. He should have caught the uncleanness from the leper.
Right. But the system short circuits. He touches the untouchable, but he doesn't become defiled. And he takes it further with the dietary laws, too.
Yeah, in Mark.
Yeah, Mark 7 notes that Jesus just dismantles them. He says, nothing that enters a person from the outside can defile them. And the text explicitly adds, in saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean. He just takes this massive centuries-old architecture of physical separation and knocks it down.
It's a complete mechanical reversal.
Mm.
In the Old Testament, impurity is contagious.
Mm.
But with Jesus, the dynamic flips entirely. His holiness is what is contagious.
Oh, that's an interesting way to put it.
The healing radiates outward. He touches the unclean. But instead of the Son becoming defiled, the unclean person is transformed and made whole.
Okay, so we've laid out the evidence, and the contradictions are just massive. You have the Father demanding burn for burn, mandating stoning, commanding the total destruction of the Amalekites, and forcing lepers out of the camp.
Right.
And then you have the Son saying, turn the other cheek, saving the adulterer, rebuking divine violence, and actively embracing the leper.
The symptoms are very clear. Now we have to look at the cure.
Exactly. How does Orthodox Christianity survive this? Because honestly, if you look at this objectively, the most logical conclusion is that these are two completely different deities. Like the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament just cannot be the same being.
And that is exactly what some people concluded.
No way, really?
Oh, yeah. If we look at the historical stakes here, this isn't just a modern thought experiment.
Mm.
In the second century, an early Christian leader named Marcion looked at these exact texts, the violence of the Old Testament versus the grace of the New, and he actually did split God in two. He argued that the wrathful creator God of the Old Testament was a completely different inferior entity to the loving Father revealed by Jesus.
Wait, so early Christians actually tried to throw the Old Testament out entirely because of this tension?
Yes.
Yeah.
The Marcionites were a massive movement. But Orthodox scholars recognize that if you sever the New Testament from its historical roots, the whole theological narrative just collapses.
Okay, so what did they do?
So they had to establish a baseline, which theologians call the spiritual constant. Orthodox Christianity firmly holds that the Father and the Son are one in nature and one in will.
Right.
The source points to John 10:30, where Jesus says, I and the Father are one.
Okay, so because of that core non-negotiable belief, theologians categorically refuse to view these texts as literal disagreements within the Godhead. Like, the Father and Son aren't arguing in heaven.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If they're one in will, then these drastic visceral differences in their recorded actions cannot be contradictions in God's character. They must be historically reconciled. And to save the theology from fracturing, scholars developed incredibly robust frameworks. And the most prominent one we're going to look at is covenant theology.
Okay, so let's really dig into covenant theology. How does this framework explain away a command to wipe out an entire village of people?
Covenant theology argues that the Old Testament laws, the lex talionis, the strict capital punishments, the intense purity laws, they were all part of the Old Covenant. And this covenant was never intended to be a universal, eternal, ethical code for all humanity.
But wait, don't the texts present these laws as divine, absolute decrees? Like, how do theologians justify demoting God's absolute commands to just, you know, temporary local ordinances without undermining the authority of the text entirely?
That is the genius and really the tension of the framework.
Yeah.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, covenant theology asserts that the Old Covenant was essentially a civic constitution.
A civic constitution. Okay.
Designed exclusively for the ancient nation of Israel in a deeply brutal, unstable, ancient Near Eastern context. To understand it, think of scaffolding around a building.
Scaffolding. Okay, I'm listening.
Scaffolding is rigid. It's ugly. It restricts movement. You wouldn't want to live inside it, right?
No, definitely not.
But mechanically, it is absolutely necessary to build a towering cathedral. Ancient Israel was surrounded by warring empires, rampant disease, and societal instability.
Right. It was a rough neighborhood.
Very. The strict laws, capping blood feuds with eye for an eye, limiting the spread of disease through severe isolation, those were the scaffolding. They were temporary, rigid structures meant for the sheer physical preservation of the people and the rudimentary moral education of a society in its infancy.
Oh, I see. So the scaffolding isn't evil or wrong, but once the cathedral is built, like once the new covenant of universal grace is inaugurated by Jesus, the scaffolding's purpose is fulfilled. You tear it down.
Precisely.
So it's not a contradiction. It's a completed construction project.
That's a great way to put it. The overarching goal was always the preservation, education, and ultimate redemption of humanity. The methods were wildly, viscerally different because the eras were completely different. The strict civil preservation of ancient Israel paved the way for the radical grace modeled by Jesus, which perfectly leads into the sister framework here, which is progressive revelation.
Right, because if you're building a cathedral, you don't start with the stained glass windows.
Exactly.
So is it a bit like parenting? You know, you give a toddler rigid, non-negotiable rules, like don't touch the stove.
Yes, perfect analogy.
But as they grow into teenagers, you teach them the underlying principles of safety and grace. Is that basically progressive revelation? The idea that God didn't reveal his entire nature and will to humanity all at once.
That is exactly it. It posits that humanity simply couldn't handle the full revelation of grace early on. God progressively revealed more of his character as human civilization matured over centuries, and it culminated in the ultimate revelation of the Son.
And the source material brings up Hebrews 1:3 regarding this, and this is where the implications get genuinely profound and, frankly, a little controversial.
Yes, they do. Hebrews 1:3 states that the Son is the exact imprint of God's nature.
Mm-hmm.
Some theologians take this to its logical and radical conclusion regarding the ultimate revelation of God's character. If Jesus is the perfect, exact representation of who God is, then anything in the ancient text that contradicts the character of Jesus has to be reevaluated.
Hold on. Are you saying that this framework suggests that some of the harsher, more violent actions attributed to God the Father in the Old Testament might actually just be ancient human misunderstandings of the divine will?
For some theologians, yes, absolutely. It's a lens used to reconcile the extreme violence.
Wow.
When ancient Israel went out and slaughtered the Amalekites, infants, donkeys, and all, they firmly believed they were executing God's divine command. But if Jesus arrives and commands us to love our enemies and halts the stoning of the guilty, the implication is that ancient humans might have been projecting their own brutal warfare tactics onto God.
That is a massive shift in perspective.
It is. The idea is that Jesus arrives to correct the historical record and show what divine justice actually looks like, that it's restorative, not strictly retributive.
But doesn't that make the entire Old Testament incredibly messy?
Mm.
I mean, if you admit that the ancient writers might have just misunderstood God, you're opening a massive can of worms about the reliability of the text.
It absolutely opens a can of worms.
Yeah.
And it maintains the tension. These frameworks, covenant theology, progressive revelation, they are brilliant, but they don't wrap everything up in a neat little bow.
No, definitely not.
Reading a command for the total annihilation of a village alongside a command to love your enemies remains a profoundly uncomfortable intellectual exercise.
Yeah, I'd say so.
But these frameworks provide a mechanism to understand why the text reads the way it does without just throwing it out completely. They really are the life rafts of Orthodox theology.
So what does this all mean? We started by looking at what seemed like a totally fractured foundation. The Father demanding an eye for an eye, the Son commanding us to turn the other cheek. Mandates for stoning and total warfare, contrasted with Jesus actively protecting the guilty and rebuking divine violence. We saw absolute isolation for the unclean, and Jesus reaching out to touch the untouchable.
The symptoms of a massive textual divide.
But by digging into the mechanics, we see that scholars haven't just ignored these contradictions. They've built massive architectural frameworks to house them. Using covenant theology and progressive revelation, they trace a distinct intentional movement, a progression from the rigid, brutal scaffolding of ancient civil preservation to the fully realized cathedral of radical universal grace.
And understanding that progression, whether you agree with all of it or not, is an incredibly powerful tool for you as a reader.
Absolutely.
When you see ancient biblical laws being quoted in modern contexts, or when you hear debates about biblical literalism on the news, you don't have to just see a flat list of contradictory rules.
Right. You have a lens now.
Exactly. You can spot the scaffolding. You understand the complex theological architecture that scholars have wrestled with for thousands of years.
It gives you a completely different lens for reading history. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over.
Let's hear it.
We talked about that provocative idea from Hebrews 1:3, that Jesus is the ultimate revelation that actively corrects ancient human misunderstandings of the divine will. Well, if ancient people firmly believed their rigid, brutal rules were divine, unquestionable mandates, only to have them dismantled later as humanity matured, it makes you wonder, what rigid rules or seemingly unquestionable societal laws do we hold on to today with absolute certainty that future generations might look back on and realize we completely misunderstood?
The scaffolding of our own time.
Yeah.
It's an unsettling but, you know, essential question.
It really makes you think. Thank you for joining us on this custom deep dive. We hope we helped clear up some of those ancient muddy waters for you. Keep questioning the framework, keep looking for the underlying mechanics, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.